issues when you move into a history class? What are the differences that you see when you move from sociology to history or English to history? What are the demands of a history course in terms of writing that are different or distinct in some way?
Yeah, everyone always wonders, what about footnoting? Especially if we're going to discuss and focus on what first-year students expect and what the upper-level students expect. You know, footnoting, what's the guidelines
Well, there are a lot of good published ones, for starters, and there are a number of good cheap guides that you can buy. You know, we have one that we stock in the bookstore that's about $8, and so that's very handy. The key thing to keep on, historians really annoy all the other disciplines because we've stuck to this rather older style, and there is a very hidebound element, conservative element to the discipline. I mean, we aren't really receptive to a lot of change in terms of what we do in terms of writing. You know, what's interesting is we do a lot of different things in terms of research, and we're very adaptable and fluid in that sense. But when it comes to the actual process of writing, historians are fairly conservative. And footnoting is the area where we've been, you know, lambasted principally by students and by publishers. History books have got this great long string of footnotes at the back, you know, or endnotes, typically now.
Well, I can tell this discussion is going to be confessional in nature, and we'll be apologizing for history. But it seems that we've already started our discussion, so let me welcome you to the third in our series on writing in the disciplines. Today we're joined by John Belshaw, professor of history at UCC, and you're talking about footnotes. And if it is dead, you know, it died in 1985, according to the MLA. So what's it doing showing up in your history?
Saving a lot of ink, basically.
Don't historians use computers?
Yes, they do. And that's just an easy, you know, paste command. Is that you just put IBIDs all through. Now, it's OPSIT actually survives too, and if you look hard, you can still see small herds of items working their way through EndNote pages. LOXITs are all but extinct. What historians are focused on with footnotes, the standard rule has to be you have to be able to find the source that the person's citing. If they haven't given you enough clues, haven't given you enough indication, then it doesn't work. Where sociologists will draw on a set of secondary materials, you know, something by Weber, something by Durkheim, whatever, and they can parenthetically do that in the text. Because of the nature of historians' resources, the manuscripts we use, photographs, web page stuff, whatever, they tend to require a lot more detail. I mean, how are you going to find a specific letter between a school teacher in the Nicola Valley to her mother in Nova Scotia that's contained within a set of papers dealing with the establishment of a private school in the Nicola Valley it's held in the private papers of a certain collection that's all been herded together under the provincial secretary's papers? Unless you've got a footnote that's fairly elaborate and detailed, anyone reading your stuff isn't going to be able to find it. And the rule of thumb here is, I think a really fairly altruistic and generous one, that is, I do research which I want to share with you, so that even if this is a minor part in my argument, it's evidence for your paper. So you should be able to chase that up. I want to share with you what I have found so that it can be made useful for you.
On the basis of what you're saying, then, is it a reasonable assumption that a student coming in first or second year into a history course better pay attention to such things as documentation style and footnoting?
Very much so. There are two reasons for doing that. One is it's a big part of the discipline. Getting right, that generosity aspect is important. Sharing your research is important. Secondly, you want to identify who you're borrowing ideas from, and that's part of academic honesty. Going through that process, I think, is a way in which students find out when they've actually had their own idea, when they've reached their own conclusion too. Hey, this is my idea. It's one which is shared by, you know, Donald Creighton or Harold Innes or whatever. But that's my idea, and I can also identify in footnotes who agrees with me.
This is something that it seems to me we've been addressing in the last couple of interviews as well. First with English and then especially with sociology. This notion of my idea or my topic. Many of my students, and I think it's a general impression I'm getting from our discussions here, question whether they can have their idea or their topic when they're writing for an audience that ostensibly knows more than they do in the subject area, that they kind of mime or mimic what goes on in the field, but they don't feel an ownership of those ideas. Is it possible for a student in first through fourth year to to come up with something that they can call my idea, my topic that they're developing?
Well, I think in history, one of the things you're trying to do in an essay is present a case. This is a fairly well-established practice amongst historians to approach the problem from this angle, to say, imagine yourself as the prosecuting attorney. You're trying to convince the jury that this person's guilty, or that this indeed has happened, or events happened in this order, and these were the important elements of those events. What I try to do when I'm phrasing essay questions is to posit the question in such a way so the student has to come up with their own particular case. So account for the failure of the Northwest Rebellion, something like that. Well, what you have to do at that point is sit through the material and decide, well, what do you think were the important elements? Now, if you read only one book, then yes, you'll have the same important elements that one author had. But if you check two or three, you'll find that, of course, there's quite a bit of discussion about this. And at the end of the day, you have to decide. And that is your idea.
Mm-hmm.
Your first idea goes down on the very first page. It is my perception that these are the important events. These were the elements that really mattered, my lord. And, please convict on this basis. And so you come in with your own ideas, and it's important to see the student in the essay, not just the sources.
You're asking students to move easy within the harness of an assigned question.
Yeah.
And it's your working assumption that a novice historian can find some particular detail to examine within that broader question that you've assigned.
I think so. Because we don't make them so narrow that they can't find, I hope anyways, if 404 students might disagree with this, that's so damn narrow, I couldn't work. There are always a couple of different avenues one can pursue, and if one wants to look at, and with history, the advantage of dealing with a large temporal period generally, and so you can compare changes over decades, you can compare changes, historical changes, as they pertain to a single individual. Individuals change over time. That's why biographies are worth having. It may be very old-fashioned, but that's what's really interesting about it. Personality, character changes. Well, what are the important changes there? Ideas develop change. So within that, I think it's possible for even a first-year student to find that defining moment, that turning point in an event, and settle on that. Well, what was the turning point in World War I? What was the turning point in the fortunes of the Liberal Party in the 1970s and 80s.
Well, let's turn over here and find out if you're convinced. Do you have enough freedom to take ownership of ideas within a course like history course?
I think it depends on the freedom you mean. You mentioned this is what I'm presenting as a first or second year course, because I know we're not exactly too much liberty to put personal into it.
Essay is
more analytical.
Pronoun.
The personal pronoun, yeah.
Well, the use of the personal pronoun is something we talk about a fair bit, isn't it? I mean, whether or not I should have I, or this is my idea. And historians, again, being fairly conservative animals, tend to say, well, it's your paper. I know it's, I feel you don't need this, redundant, so don't do it. But having said that, there are times when that can be a useful tool. It's not a rigid rule, but I think it's a useful one, particularly for undergraduates, to try and objectify the question and try and approach it within something like laboratory conditions.
There's a distinction, though, to be made, isn't there, between using the first-person pronoun and having a personal investment in the topic that you're writing on.
And I think you can. In the assembly of your evidence, you've got your personal involvement. That can come through directly in the writing. One does see from time to time, what I have found to be the most important thing in this list of important factors is this. But ultimately, it's the way you assemble the information. There are a number of nice lines in E.H. Carr's book, What is History, that I like to cite. There are a number of lines, but one or two that come to mind, the line from Pirandello, a fact is like a sack, it won't stand up until you put something in it. Well, what did you put into that fact? That's your investment. You've put something into that. Let's let the facts speak for themselves. But we have to have a speaker's list, don't we? We can't just let them all crowd to the front of the stage. We give them a speaker's list. We say, well, these are the facts I'm going to let speak on behalf of this question. That's your personal involvement. You've made that choice.
Well, Well, here you are espousing literature, quoting Pirandello. How close is history to English studies? I know that you believe from our previous conversations that history is a narrative art form.
Yes, it is.
That's something that we didn't hear from the sociologists we were talking to last day. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by a narrative art form?
Well, history is the only discipline that really straddles humanities and social sciences almost perfectly. You know, if you look at in the UCC BA, general BA program, you've got to have so many social sciences and so many humanities courses, at least that used to be the case. I think that's still in place. And in the history department, there were UBC in their calendar, they're almost half and half. And we went through this one year and we said, well, the 20th century history courses, they had one in Germany, the US, Britain, and Canada, two were humanities, two were social science courses. What really came down to was the personality of the person teaching, the individual teaching the course. Straddling the two means that historians focus very heavily on what can be described very cautiously as objective evidence, but also presenting the story in a coherent fashion. And historians do use novels, they do use literature a fair bit as resources, so we're very keen to, or we're very much aware of the demands of language and the implications of language, so we want to tell a good story. It's about telling stories at the end of the day. You assemble your facts from the social science perspective, bring them over, try and display them.
It must be difficult for a novice coming in, mm-hmm. to sort out that social science component and the humanities component, mm-hmm. because they do seem to dovetail. I mean, even in your own writing, Dr. Belcher, which I have a sample of.
Here's one I kept earlier.
I noticed, for example, this is entitled Cradle to Grave, an Examination of Demographic Behavior on Two British Columbian Frontiers. Wake up. By John Douglas Belshaw. Resume?
Yes.
The abstract begins, this paper begins an exploration of British Columbia's historical demography. It assesses rates of nuptiality. The findings indicate a greater role for non-native women. Fertility rates are described well. It's all in the passive voice. It sounds very much like a social science report. But we only have to go one page over, and we get some very fine writing that somebody in an English department would recognize as being indeed kind of poetic here. I mean, listen to these lines. No factor so fully fashioned nor so ably mirrored frontier life as did population change. Influxes of immigrants, however, are only part of the equation, and a preliminary part at that. There's a nice kind of informal sense there, very conversational. And then one page over, you begin to tell a story. Of the pair, looking at Nanaimo and Kamloops as these two regions, of the pair, Nanaimo is far better known to historians than Kamloops. Its colorful history of violent and protracted industrial disputes, larger-than-life characters like the mine-owning Dunsmuir clan and the town's success as a settlement by the 1870s, have attracted both historians and playwrights, and so you go on. Is there a kind of a split personality to writing history papers that reveals itself as you play off narrative? Because that's clearly narrative, but I'm getting wrapped up now in a story in a way I wasn't from the abstract, which sounded quite dull.
Well, the abstract's meant to sound dull. This is something you said.
You succeeded.
I succeeded. Yes, on all fronts, a dull abstract and an interesting text. Well, there you are. For historians, it doesn't seem to us like a split personality. The research part, I suppose, is the point at which you become very much the social scientist. And I'm right at the moment in the midst of going through materials on population history in Kamloops at the turn of the century, trying to determine different household formation patterns. And it's fairly arid stuff, and I've got it all on DBase form. We translate it into SPSS, and we knock the numbers back and forth to get out the pencil and add it all up.
You don't sound enthusiastic enough.
At this stage, I'm not. Think again what this is. work on that. But then once I've got all that data together, then I get into the fun stuff, which is the writing up. Mm-hmm. And that's much more that's much more pleasurable. It's much more enjoyable. It's the artistic part of it. And I think one of the attractive things about history for me is that you get to do that great detective work, which is really interesting. I find exciting. But you also get to write. You get to use language in an interesting way.
So this is this narrative art that you're referring to. Is it generally true then that writing is important to historians, the way that you phrase things, the way you present your ideas?
Absolutely. If you look at the leading historians, the people everybody admires, people like Eric Hobsbawm, the late E.P. Thompson, Fernand Braudel, what distinguishes their work, I think, as much as anything else, isn't just the acuity of their thought processes, the absolute razor-sharp analysis. It's also their use of language, the way in which they draw on literature, the way in which they create images, use fresh metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely true. Do you want me to read an example?
Sure.
I have some I brought with me. I've got a Canadian, a French, and a British sample here, and I'll just give you an example. First from Working Families. This is by Bettina Bradbury. It's about life in industrializing Montreal. And what she's describing here is the way in which people manage and stretched wages in downtown Montreal. Pigs and fowl were cheaper to purchase and to keep than a cow. They cost virtually nothing to raise as they scavenged for themselves in the courtyards and at the roadside. And they required little space, being kept in yards, basements, or even inside houses. Unlike gardening, keeping animals was not limited to families with plenty of space. In some fairly densely populated streets, families living in rear houses, duplexes, and row houses were keeping both pigs and cows. A walk along George or Catherine Street in St. Anne Ward, one of the densest areas of pig keeping, was as likely to involve skirting pigs or cows and their droppings as it was to encounter the unruly playing children of the neighborhood. This conjures up a wonderful image of this, well, not wonderful, very smelly image, actually, of this particular neighborhood. It's not simply a concentration of numbers. You know, when we're looking at history from below, the mass of the population, those people who don't leave behind them diaries, journals, a lot of correspondence, we have to go in through the social sciences avenue, looking at census returns, government reports, and the rest. And what she's done with that material is created an image of a place. You know, it's they're scavenging for themselves in the courtyards and at the roadside. The image is there. The
sounds like a passage from D.H. Lawrence.
Yes, it does.
It reads like literature. Which is that, what are you, a closet novelist?
Novelist, absolutely.
Yeah?
Just wait. This is a passage from Emmanuel Roy Ladurie's monumental piece on Montaillou, which is a little parish in the Pyrenees. In the Middle Ages, Ladurie was interested in the Inquisition generally, and the Inquisitors left behind them tremendous records of life in these little communities that were very remote, and like most of the Annales school in France, he's concerned to describe how human behavior fits within larger environmental factors, you know, people moving up and down the valleys and the hillsides as the seasons change, following their flocks, their herds, and the rest. I was saying to Will earlier, I picked this off the shelf because I really like this book, and I go back to it regularly, and I just flipped open, and I came to this page. It's always something to quote. But it was not really illness that mattered in Upper Ariège. That was only an epiphenomena. What mattered was death. It was a nice four-word sentence. What mattered was death. Death unadorned, without fine phrases, falling like an executioner's knife, without warning, or at least without any warning recorded by our witnesses. This is great. What mattered was death. Good, great point.
You guys are setting high standards.
Yeah, we are, you know, very demanding. And even more literate, I think, is Eric Hobsbawm, who is, if you don't know, God. He would reject the title, of course. One of the things, Hobsbawm is probably the best known writer in history in the English language right now. Came out with a book about a year and a half ago called The Age of Extremes. Age of Extremes, got rid of the start, which looks at the 20th century as a whole. And, you know, if you only buy one history book, if you only ever read one history book from front to back, this is it. This is the one you've got to read. It's your century, and it's brilliant. He's a left-wing historian, a socialist, who's managed to retain that dedication to the left throughout all the neoliberal stuff, the witch hunts, the 1956, the Hungarian invasion, this sort of stuff. Well, he's writing a piece, this is an article that came out in 1958 called History in the Dark Satanic Mills, and it deals with the debate between what he calls the optimists or the cheerful school of the standard living debate, which said that basically things were getting better and better throughout the Industrial Revolution, and the pessimists or the glums who believe that in fact things were getting pretty damn bad for the masses. Let us sum up. In Thomas Peacock's novel, Crochet Castle, published in 1831, there is a moment when the discussions of the upper-class characters assembled in Chainmail Hall are interrupted by a crowd at the door. Captain Swing has come, the revenge of the working classes, and the miserable farm laborers have risen. The Reverend Dr. Folliot, an intelligent Tory, says, "Here is proof of the march of mind, the progress about which the capitalists are always bragging, the peasant war." Mr. McQueedy, the Scots economist, who stands for the pure ideology of capitalism, says this is impossible. How can the peasant war and the march of mind be brought together? Mr. Chainmail, the romantic reactionary, says the cause is the same in the Dark Ages as in the present, poverty and despair. And Dr. Folliot sums it up. It is the natural result, Mr. McQueedy, of that system of state seamanship which your science of bourgeois political economy upholds. Putting the crew on short allowances and doubling the rations of the officers is a sure way to make a mutiny on board a ship in distress, Mr. McQueedy. That is how England looked to intelligent members of the ruling classes in the period which is now ineffectually being whitewashed. The description is correct, though we may quarrel with the analysis. Nothing the cheerful school have done has invalidated it. But in case we are tempted by these quotations from ruling class sources to get mistaken ideas about those who have made them, it is just worth quoting the continuation of the dialogue. "We have not time to discuss cause and effect now," said Dr. Folliot. "Let us get rid of the enemy." And the assembled members of the ruling class drop their analyses, take up arms, and rush out of Chainmail Hall to scatter the miserable laborers into the night.
You're obviously in love with this guy, aren't you?
He's God.
We can't stop you from reading.
I'll stop now.
But you've moved from D.H. Lawrence to Henry Fielding here, it sounds like, in terms of the presentation.
And most historians tend to glom on to a novelist.
A novelistic style?
Yeah, well, a novelist, an individual novelist is generally influential on a historian's style, and you see them being quoted repeatedly. Sometimes bad novelists, sometimes good novelists. And most historians model themselves on another senior historian. Mm-hmm. Most of us try to be E.J. Hobsbawm, Eric Hobsbawm, but settle for something a little more modest. You know?
Something slightly below God is...
Something below God, yeah, that's right.
We've only got a few minutes left.
I'm sorry, I've used up a lot.
Sorry?
I've used up a lot of time.
Yes, you certainly have. We've only got a few minutes left here, and maybe this is a good point to turn it back to the classroom setting and begin asking how these issues that you've mapped out and the field that you've mapped out, which is attractive yet probably intimidating at the same time, how does one gain entry into that? And maybe a good way to ask it is a question that we've been floating before in here, and that is, what's the difference between expectations of a first-year student as opposed to expectations of a fourth-year student? And maybe that will give us some sense of the escalating demands of history.
Okay. I think one of the disadvantages history suffers under, or labors under, is that while in school, in high schools, and from elementary school, students are exposed to novels quite a bit, they're very seldom exposed to histories. Mm-hmm. First years do come into the class and, I've got to read a history book. I hadn't had to do this before. We had a social studies book which had a chapter on history, and that was as close as we came to it. And so in the first instance, the main thing one will accomplish, I think, in a first-year course is to introduce students to history, to introduce them to critical thinking, and in the writing of papers, to introduce them to the idea of organizing thoughts in this analytical way to present a case, but also to
Analysis
plus description, yeah. They have to tell the story, too. For the fourth years, we're looking for more, I think on the whole, certainly my classes, we're looking for a more varied use of resources, a more critical approach to primary sources and secondary sources. That's really what makes out the difference. I expect first-year students to say, but look, it says here in this book that Louis Riel was mad. Yeah, but it says in this one that he wasn't, you know. That's fine. If they cited their source and said, Louis Riel was crazy, here's my source, fine. Mm-hmm. By the fourth year, expect students to take those documents to task a bit.
This has become a familiar theme, even in the three interviews that we've done. The notion of negotiating your own perspective among competing views and competing perspectives. Where would that go in the paper? In the introduction?
It depends. A good paper begins with a very straightforward, in history, begins with a very straightforward statement. Can I read one thing?
Sure.
I brought a sample with me. Purely anonymous. The story of the Tronchial Sanatorium is the story of the fight against tuberculosis. Bang. Now, you know what the story is about. This is the story of the Tronchial Sanatorium, and it's about TB. It spans half a century in British Columbia. Over the history and eventual success, often the history and eventual success of the institution has been written with a focus on the latter half of its lifetime, when modern procedures for treating TB became so advanced that it ceased to be feared and eventually led to the institution's demise. Was Tronchial the success the narratives portray? It's about the Tronchial Sanatorium, and the question is, was it that successful? Great.
So you've got a clear sense of direction.
You know exactly where you're going to go, the question they're going to be asked, and then the student lays out how they're going to approach that, looking at the organizing it in terms of different administrative structures and different time periods. You know exactly where they're going.
Where are these competing viewpoints, though, that you've
written? There is the competing viewpoint right there, right from the start. The more contemporary view, the tail end of the story of Tronchial, is one that says it was a great success. If we look at the early period, what we see is a horrific death rate from TB, probably not the right place to put the sanatorium in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So the more presentist view is it was a great thing, we were lucky to have it. Now let's take the historical perspective. Throughout the history of something like Tronchial Sanatorium or UCC or any other big institution, there are always going to be people saying, we're doing a great job, we're doing a great job, we're doing a great job. Part of the historian's job when analyzing institutions is to get under that and see, you know, were there competing viewpoints? And of course there were.
So you, writing a history paper, then you must indeed involve yourself in competing viewpoints. You have to be able to be comfortable amidst possible confusion initially as you're sorting out your topic.
Yeah, very much so. And if it's something to do with, well, the area which has seen the most growth in the last while, discourse analysis, the competing views very often come right down to just the words we choose to use to describe a particular event. Was it a rebellion? Was it an uprising? Are we talking about a sovereignty association referendum or a separatism referendum? Those kinds of issues, the way in which language is used, quite apart from the gendered and racial aspect of language, those represent competing views in and of themselves. Assembling, I did a paper at a conference in October where I was looking at the language that's used in population discourses in BC. And what came up more often than not was when people said they were doing population histories, basically they were talking about just populating histories. And it was just a question of the accumulation of numbers. They were standing at this end of history and saying, look at all the people. What a great, successful population history we've got. You know, turn the telescope around. So mm-hmm. You start with those conflicting views that are already embedded in language.
Well, I hope this has sorted out some conflicting views about writing history papers. Is that too bad a segue?
That's a good segue.
It's not bad.
Okay.
Thank you very much, John, for joining us.
And
thank you, the panel. Thank you.
Okay.
Are you going to answer your Rubik's Cube question?
Don't we want to take a stab at it? It's a writer's block, so...